This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Joyful, joyful.
Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. This is the show where we talk about spirituality and sexuality for our community.
Good evening, faithful listeners. You're listening to the Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9 every Thursday from 8 until 9. My name is Tal Meritz. I'm here with you. And the first thing we'll be doing today is actually talking about our holy day of the week.
For a miracle. Are you ready for a miracle?
So our holy day of the week actually is not a traditional. The idea of the holy day of the week is that we want to talk about a religious festival that's coming up, because as I always kind of notice, especially when it's a festival that is not from the faith that people are actually members of, they end up reading about them later on in the paper, or they sort of say, oh, I heard that yesterday it was this festival, and I think it would be better always if we learned about festivals before they came instead of immediately after. However, this week is not a normal holy day of the week. It actually happens to be my birthday tomorrow, and so I thought, I was looking a little sparse, and I said, well, why don't we actually look at the origin of birthdays? I thought that would be a fun one, a little bit different, because if you think about it, we have so many rituals when it comes to a birthday. In many cases, it probably reminds people of religious festivals in that way sometimes. So I thought we'd actually look, because it actually does have religious origins. They just happen to be of religions that no longer exist. So the earliest known mention of a birthday is actually in the Bible. It's in Genesis of the Hebrew Bible, and it talks about the Pharaoh. So it wasn't the Israelites having birthdays, but it was the Egyptians. And it mentions the Pharaoh having a birthday feast. Now, it's worth noting that would place the first mention of a birthday being about 3,000 BC. However, it's worth noting, I'm always a bit wary about using the Bible as a historical document. I think for one, you know, the immediate things that jump to mind is, well, even if that's the case, even if this mention is correct, then it was written probably not at the time, so then we have people writing later who didn't, basically what I'm saying is that the people that received it, or when the Bible was compiled, they themselves never met that particular Pharaoh, had that birthday. So perhaps it was slightly later or whatever it is, but there is at least one archaeologist that argues that this isn't a birthday as much as maybe a coronation ceremony, because the pharaohs were considered to be gods. If he was having a coronation ceremony, becoming the pharaoh, it's sort of him becoming a god. He is being, I guess, birthed as a new god. So maybe that's really what we're seeing, and it's not quite the same as a birthday the way we mean it. Meanwhile, though, the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, were the ones that first had the idea of the cakes with the candles on them. So the Greeks gave moon cakes to the lunar god Artemis. Makes sense, you give moon cakes to a moon god. But this isn't so much a birthday situation, obviously. This is something being given for a god during that festival. However, they did put little candles on the cakes, and it was one that struck me. It was like, that makes so much more sense. I always thought that the birthday candles and a cake don't really, there's not much connection between a birthday and having candles on it. Except if you think about the origin being for a lunar god, it makes sense that the moon cake would sort of have this bright light shining from it. So these rituals, of course, existed too in some form. They developed throughout Europe. And it wasn't until around the 18th, 19th century in Germany that people started putting a candle on a cake for every year of a child's birthday. So as much as there were candles putting on cakes, the way we do it is not very old at all. That's it's barely 200 years old. However, in Rome, it was the first evidence that family and friends celebrated birthdays. So we have, I guess if you want to go back, we have a mention of something Egypt. We have rituals that are similar in Greece. But it was really in Rome that we had birthdays the way we mean them. Previously, everyone else was having a birthday for gods, but these were having birthdays for people. However, once again, I guess when we're talking about these ancient times, it's a bit hard to tell how much we really had them. We know they were just for the men. Women apparently didn't have birthdays in Rome, but it was just for men. But we don't really know, was everyone having a birthday? Was it the social elite that had birthdays? But either way, we do know that whoever was celebrating these birthdays, close family and friends would gather together and sort of feast with them. So that's kind of that one suddenly developing. Now, as a result of these very quote-unquote pagan rituals, Christians were initially quite skeptical of birthdays. They were rituals for worshipping gods, so it would be tough for Christians to continue it. However, it was about 400 years before Christians started celebrating birthdays, but not of each other. They, in a sense, you could say that Christians also started developing birthday ritual, because it's about 400 years until Christians started celebrating Christmas. And functionally, if you think about it, Christmas is the equivalent of many of these others where people celebrate the birth of a god. However, I can understand that some people might be like, no, it's not like that, blah, 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 which is, it's worth noting, it's actually because of those pagan origins of birthdays, and in a sense, Christmas is why Jehovah's Witnesses do not celebrate any birthdays, Christmas, and actually on top of that, they don't celebrate Easter as well, which I always thought was a bit sad, but, you know, that's what they're going to do. But yeah, so I think that's an important one to note, is that we actually do have a Christian group which doesn't celebrate birthdays. Now, the last one I will mention here is that we have the origin of the song Happy Birthday to You. It was actually only written in 1893, but it was originally called Good Morning to You, and it was developed as sort of a children's kindergarten song, and it was about in the 1930s that then the lyrics were redone as for a birthday. So those are our different ones, but I'm actually not going to leave you with the birthday song. I'm actually going to leave you with Weird Al Yankovic's version of the birthday song, and this is Weird Al with Happy Birthday, and you're listening to the Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. Welcome, our good faithful listeners. Now, I'm talking to Paul here. It's actually Reverend Doctor, I think my understanding is. I didn't actually quite realize that until...
Sounds impressive, doesn't it?
I know, suddenly. I've always liked the idea of people that sort of had not just Doctor, but like Reverend Doctor. And, you know, sometimes I've come across people who are the Honourable, Honourable Justice Doctor. I think you can just keep going, just collect titles. But... Look, Paul, like I said, so you are a reverend. Maybe you want to quickly tell us about how that came about.
Well, look, here I am. I'm a minister in the Uniting Church in Australia, have been so for about 20 years. I came from another place, another land, and I've had a rich experience working with congregations in Melbourne, and now I'm kind of semi-retired, all care and no responsibility.
Right, so... Now, could you maybe tell us a little about your religious upbringing?
I had quite a pious parents, I think, and We were taught to read a bit of the Bible every night after tea, not just on Friday. And we listened to Dad pray until he asked us to share in reading the Bible and saying some prayers. And we kind of learnt that from Mum and Dad.
So what was the actual... That's a Christian background, but what was the actual... Sort of more specifically, the sort of sect that you came from?
This was a Baptist family background.
And you were church going?
Yeah, we had church on Sunday morning and we had Sunday school beforehand. We also had a youth service at night and we did evangelistic things to try and get others to come along as well.
Right, actually. So you also, you did a bit of proselytizing?
Well, it was natural for Baptists and other groups in those days to try and draw others in. Evangelism, it was very much come and share with us as kind of what we call the come policy, excuse me, listeners. And we had to learn that there's a go policy to go out and talk to people and engage them in conversation where they're at, which is where my life has gone, I guess, in the last 20 years.
I'll quickly go. Do you think how many people... Do you think that the evangelizing was all that successful? Did many people get involved as a result?
Well, look, you see, one of the things groups did was door knocking. So if you put some pamphlets in the letterboxes and you went down 100 homes and knocked on the door, you'd probably talk to five householders who are very glad that someone had come by. And you might get one that might like to join in the community and become part of it. So it's a matter of what you think is worthwhile for... You know, one, as Jesus said, one lost sheep, perhaps.
So at what point did you start to identify less with Christianity?
Well, I still do identify with Jesus, but Christianity as an institution has had its problems, and we all know what they are. And it's been important for me and colleagues of mine to focus on the way that Jesus followed, his openness to people, his being out there, and that has changed our perspective away from an institutional point of view.
What specifically were the kind of things that bothered you about, as you would say, the institution of Christianity?
Well, look, that's probably not a very fruitful direction to go. Every institution has its... value. It provides a place and a belonging for people, a formation. But if you have a formation in the cocoon of a church or another community, you may then grow in a wider context and find you want to be formed by other influences outside of that community.
Right. So the reason I brought some of this up is that it was my impression that you did not believe in God.
Oh, no, that would be too simple. But I talk to atheists, but we don't talk about belief in God. It's kind of a dead-end street nowadays. We've got to be a bit more subtle. And I was really glad to come on this program because you're talking about spirituality and maybe spirituality and sexuality. You're talking about things that are more close to home and that are the common human experience of all people. And I suppose that's a fruitful area for dialogue with all kinds of people.
So did you at some point, at what point did you start to pull away, I guess, a little from it? Or well, I guess at what point did you start to quote-unquote secularize? I know nothing's ever as simple as that, but...
Well, look, at the age of 11, as I clearly remember in the lodge, I sat in Bible class at the front of the church on the steps and realized that I didn't believe what... the Bible class teacher was telling us that particular thing. I don't know what it was, but I had a sense that I was starting to question. And so I've had to be a person questioning right through my life. But I guess I feel I've narrowed down my sense of faith to a very minimal set of beliefs, which I would call being kind of agnostic. I'm willing to say I don't know a lot. And to try and seek a common understanding with anybody, whatever their culture and spirituality is, and see what is it, what is our universal experience, what does our common experience point to, instead of what's your belief and what's mine and let's have an argument.
So in many respects, it would probably strike people that it could be considered, you know, an odd choice to become a reverend if you're, out as an agnostic.
Yeah, yeah. Look, let's go backwards through that. I think for some people like myself who found that they didn't believe the mainstream of their community, and there must be many of your listeners who know what that's like, to say that you don't believe is a kind of coming out. I think that's fair. And it's like not being ashamed of your individuality is quite important. I became a minister because I was at an earlier stage of my life. I wanted to be helpful to people. I was interested in the counselling thing. And I was interested in studying the Bible, which I think you've done your own study of things from a curiosity point of view, and to dig into that rich text. And I got into Hebrew Bible because I was interested in that. That led me into discussion with Jews, Muslims, other beliefs. And now I'm talking to atheists, rationalists and agnostics about spirituality and stuff.
Do you think that the concept of spirituality even makes sense when it comes to talking to atheists?
That is a question that I'm asking, and I get different answers from different people. A friend of ours, David, spoke about the fact that he's an atheist, but he still wanted to say to the Year 10 people in the class, we'll talk about this later, that that didn't mean he wasn't spiritual, and he's got a sense of reverence for life. So reverence for life is a kind of perhaps a gateway to a common spirituality that many people share, whether or not they're religious or believe in God.
Now, the reason I, of course, yeah, brought this up is because I know that happens, and in my case, it's worth me. I don't think I've ever really spoken about this on air, but I myself don't believe in God, and as a result, sometimes the term spirituality, I'm a bit concerned about applying that to myself, not because I don't have what probably in other circumstances people would call spiritual experiences, but I sometimes get concerned that it could almost be offensive in a sense for me to kind of reappropriate that term when it doesn't quite make sense in the context. I don't know. I haven't come to a conclusion on that. That's not a hard and fast rule. But
well, I suppose if I was to sum up this bit of it, it's like I don't want to say exactly I believe in God because that means too many things to different people. But I want to put another word in. I believe in godness. I believe there's something spiritual or something transcendent about human life, animal life, the life of the world, something given, something ultimate, something universal, something enduring, and all of those things. And my sense of looking for God is to look in those aspects.
Why is it, though, that you are... What is it about a more traditional biblical view of God that you find unconvincing or unsatisfying?
About the biblical view.
Well, let's say, you're taking quite an agnostic, you know, you sort of say I'm agnostic approach. In theory, religious people, I'd say very broadly in theory, religious people are supposed to believe in God, and that means a bit, that probably means something slightly different from godness.
Well, I think the thing about it is, after talking to atheists and rationalists, I've come down to this question. Do you treat your life as a gift, as a kind of wonderful givenness that calls out a response from you? What am I going to do with this gift? Or do you take it for granted? This is mine. I'll do my own thing. And so the deepest religious sensibility is to see life as a gift and to want you to live your life in a gifting way towards other people. But you don't have to be religious to do that. But to me, that is the essence of a true kind of holiness, you know, apart from institutional religion.
You're listening to The Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9, and I'm talking to Paul. Now, Paul, you have some fairly interesting, I think, theological ideas, or at least I think so. Though I did want to note quickly, seeing we were talking about a little about atheists and spirituality, I did have at least one writer write in saying, an atheist is just a person with no invisible means of support. What do you think of that sort of claim?
I think it's a good joke, whether you're religious or atheist, to get a conversation started. Look, perhaps it goes to one thing. A lot of people think that religious people are all about needing God. Oh, dear, they need God to do stuff for them. Look, that would be a caricature of people I know in faith who are every bit as productive and have got as much initiative as any other person, and And I think their sense of God is about a partnership in life and about being responsive, as I said before, to the given of whatever's holy in the world that you want to accentuate.
Interestingly, my understanding is that you feel that Christianity needs to get a little bit back to its Jewish roots, in a sense. Is that a fair thing to say?
Well, I think that is fair. I think those of us who find ourselves on a progressive end of Christian theology feel that the whole weight of theology, of propositional truths about the Christ and the end times and the church and so on, has lost touch with an ordinary person in the street today. It's in Greek categories of thought, which are not the way people think today. And to go behind that and rediscover the figure of Jesus is quite a journey that many of us are taking.
What's most striking to me is that, obviously, I think if we were to look at Jesus, that I think it's fair to say that a lot of what Christianity had in its Jewish origins was trying to get beyond what it kind of felt at the time was sort of a slow, you could almost say, overly bureaucratic form of religion, being Judaism at the time, and then wanting to try and get back to the roots of those beliefs. But it seems you're now trying to use the same logic.
Yeah, I think
backwards.
This is something that has to be repeated as history moves on. To be specific about this, if you take the prophet Jeremiah, who lived 600 years before Jesus, about the time of Buddha, he has this amazing thing where he says, well, God's truth is going to be written on the hearts of individuals. And he says this amazing thing, nobody will need a priest. You know, and let's get back to the sense that we can all, it's a democratization of spirituality, that every person can have a sense of the holy in their own life.
So interestingly, are you then saying that one of the issues is that much of the Hebrew Bible has been neglected by Christianity?
No, well, this kind of text is, say, one of the gems, isn't it, from the Hebrew Bible. I mean, you take one book like Deuteronomy, one chapter says, go and kill the Canaanites or make them slaves and so on, and almost ethnic cleansing. Another chapter in the same book says, I am the eternal God, I have no favorites, I love the stranger, and you must love the stranger because you were strangers in Egypt. Complete contrast within close 10 chapters of Deuteronomy. So I believe we've got to actually cherry pick. People say, oh, this is not the way to read the Bible. It's holy, read it all. But no, I think we've got to examine the Bible, compare bits of it, and find what we all agree is the essence and the enduring truth of parts of it.
So do you want to, hypothetically, if someone was just to sort of open and have a little flick around, are there any sort of areas that you sort of think are neglected currently? That's a tough question. I know that's a bit of a curveball.
In the Hebrew Bible?
Yeah.
Well, look, perhaps not neglected, but if I was just to pick, say, three or four at random, take the first chapter. It's about a God who made male and female equal, and he made each one of them in the image of God. So every person has some kind of holiness. That, you know, you don't have to go far into the Bible to find something profound that's still enduring, meaningful for people today, the equality of men and women, which most of the world, including our own cultures, have struggled to actually make real in life. You can go to chapter 12. God called Abraham and said, Abraham, I'm picking you, but the reason I'm picking you is so that everybody will be blessed through you. So there's a sense there in the Jewish Bible, although the Jews have a very confined covenant in a sense of their own individuality, they are the ones who have preserved the idea that God is for everyone and has no favorites. These are profound ideas.
And certainly ideas that I identify with. So for those, I come from a progressive Jewish background, and I found it very important to study the Bible in different ways, even though I don't see it as something that was written literally by God as this perfect book.
Sure.
But I think it's very interesting. And one of the things exactly, actually, even debates about stories about Adam and Eve, and are they symbols of... I think you could argue for a long time about whether or not these are stories that enshrine gender equality or whether or not they enshrine rigid gender roles is something that people could debate. But
yeah, well, I've been reading a book lately. It's actually by a Christian scholar, but he has taken the theme of the garden and he has written a book deliberately entitled The Erotic Element in Scripture.
Sounds great.
And it's a very interesting but pretty profound read because he is able to actually transcend those texts, for example, the ones about homosexuality and so on that get quoted around. This author has gone, David Carr, has gone to more profound aspects of the kind of texts I've just mentioned, and he's showing that the erotic part of life is provided for in some of these texts, and he's taken the theme of the garden. So he's done the Garden of Eden. He's done the garden in the Song of Songs, where the two lovers are enjoying each other physically. And I love that because Christianity for most of 2,000 years has been down on sexuality, and we need to go back to the embodied sense of life in the Jewish tradition, which doesn't seem to have these same hang-ups.
I think sometimes it does.
I'm a bit naive, aren't I?
Sometimes it does, but I think in some ways, and I can identify. I mean, certainly, it's an odd thing for me to say. I sometimes don't feel comfortable suddenly having this conversation on air. I do, but it's something like, oh, I can't believe I'm going to say this. But something I always found strange is that for particularly groups where religious leaders had to be celibate, I just don't, you know, I just haven't come from a background of that kind. In many ways, in Judaism, one simply could not be a rabbi without having kids, because otherwise how can you be a leader of groups? But it did remind me that I think probably the Song of Songs is probably something that a few people need to remember is in the Bible. Sure. For those that don't know it, it's a love story between a man and a woman, and it's often used as a metaphor between a person and God. The woman is us, and the man is God, and there's this. It's filled with a lot of metaphors, to say the least.
But David Carr wants to, in a way, rescue it from that spiritualization and say it truly is about the reality and the goodness of the erotic aspect of connectedness between people on a physical level. And so that leads me to a strong sense that in my working as a minister or just as a friend, I need to help people grapple with the idea that the sexual and the spiritual are not, as might seem at first, poles apart, but they are essentially two aspects of the connectedness which human beings and maybe animals need to share in. And this is a very life-changing reality when you deal with your sexuality and your spirituality in these terms.
So, coming to then sexuality, I'm assuming that you're not about to announce that you think that homosexuality is a great sin and that everyone's going to hell. How did you sort of come to the belief I'm a bit eating my words today, but how did you end up deciding that being GLBTI, according to Christianity, was not an issue, or at least shouldn't be an issue?
Well, look, it's a long journey. There's my own personal reflection, my own experience. There's also the experience of being in a church, Uniting Church in Australia, which has tried to grapple with this and has let the voices of GLBTQI people be heard, which has now seemed happily enough accepted that we have a number of gay and lesbian ministers who are out and who are in various congregations, perhaps mostly in city churches, some doing phenomenal work. One was referred to on Q&A last Monday week ago, the church in Sydney, South Sydney, and not that the minister necessarily was gay, but so it's out of taking the responsibility to reflect on one's own experience and all of life that, you know, I've come to see this. And I want to add to it tonight, a second book that I read recently goes much further than, oh, we should just accept gays and lesbians. It says, this is really profound, the experience of gay and lesbian people of faith who are on the edge of the church is in fact a special window for everybody to understand more about the outcast, the stranger, and which is the Hebrew thing, the love of the stranger, and that they have a special sense of spirituality which they offer to the rest of us. I thought that was really a challenging and good.
So to unpack that for a moment, you're actually saying that it's not just a matter of saying, well, Christianity could have an issue and we can pick and choose, but actually saying that accepting GLBTI people is an embodiment of Christian values.
Yes, but I've gone beyond that and said to you, it's like we spent 100 years going to the Pacific and Asia to make Christians out of the Asians. What we should be doing now, which is hardly happening, we should be having them come back here. We should sit at their feet. And it's in the same way I'm saying, having realised we've certainly got to accept GLBTQI people, there's another stage to say we should consciously listen to the particular voice they give us, which and the sensitivities and sensibilities they bring. And this is spelled out in this book. I should have brought the title, but there we are, haven't got it.
What do you think of people that end up just saying, well, I can't really justify GLBTI people religiously, but I'm happy to just kind of ignore it?
Oh, well, that's just not enough. That's wimpish, obviously.
What about people that say, well, those people aren't... I've been hearing this one a lot, particularly recently again, but, oh, they themselves aren't sinners. It's just the act which is the problem.
Oh, yeah. No, look, I'll tell you, I'm going to use the word... If there are young children listening, they probably won't understand it. But I went along to Ridley College, an Anglican college, a conservative theological college, and they, bless them, had a day on sexuality and the whole gay thing. And one of the young men got up, and he was willing to come out, and he started his address, and this is what he said, don't listen, anal sex. He said this to this gathered group of very respectable people. And, you know, it made us all think, yeah, possibly behind our issues and prejudice is fear about the unknown of different ways of connectedness and, you know, as if difference was somehow bad because we're afraid of it. So there's a whole train of thought we could go down there. Maybe our listeners can think about that.
You're listening to The Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. I'm talking to Paul. Now, Paul, you actually are involved with, not just involved, but you're involved with a group called Pathways. Could you tell us what Pathways is?
Pathways is the name we took for a coalition of several faith groups and agnostic, humanist, atheist groups that found they had a common interest in putting the voices of young adults who had beliefs, convictions and passion to speak about it in a respectful way, to speak to Year 10 kids, we aiming at government schools and starting conversations about ethics and beliefs. And the phenomenal thing about it, as I say, is the fact that faith and we call free thought groups have found a common energy around the issues of ethics and education and people being informed about all the great wisdom traditions, religious, the Enlightenment, humanism, etc. So that's what it is, Pathways.
And so you have a particular program where you go into schools and have speakers that
so
talk to high school.
The upfront of this program is to send three young adults, and we call their presentation Pathways.
Ah, that's why I made that.
Pathways. And, yeah, each of them speaks for 5 minutes about their life experience. The key thing about when they speak is They're not giving a lot of information about, you know, Jews do this, Muslims do that. They say, when I was a child, I had this family heritage of belief and participation in a community. When I was a young person, I decided to wear the hijab, or I decided to give up my faith, or I stopped being a Mormon and became an atheist. Each person tells a story contrasting those early events of their life, and then they answer questions from the kids about anything they want to ask at all.
Are people friendly on the presenters?
Well, it's funny you should say that. The other day, someone asked what was to me a new question. This is after 10 years of doing this stuff. Said, did you feel you had many friends when you were young, you know, being whatever, religious and so on? But now I've forgotten your question. We get respectful questions. Young people are told they can ask anything at all, and they can be personal in a way. Our presenters can say, I don't want to answer that, or I don't know. But provided they ask in a respectful way, we'll love it because it'll get the conversation going.
Has it been difficult to find support for such a program?
Well, we are glad to say that these 11 groups have supported us, you might say, morally. We haven't depended on their money. Schools are mostly willing to pay something so we can pay our presenters because they're young adults, they need support. We have had the support of the Victoria Multicultural Commission, which is a key agency of the state government that supports a whole variety of interfaith. And we call this interbelief because it's not just faith. It's also about wider beliefs and philosophies.
Has it been difficult wanting to include secular speakers, an atheist or variations?
Look, it all began this way. I was doing a prior program, Mark II, I call it, where I was putting maybe a Buddhist and a Sikh and a Christian or a Muslim in front of a class. And I offered this to a school northwest of Melbourne. And the teacher wrote back and said an amazing thing. He said, we'd love to have a presentation, but could you include an atheist? And that set my mind buzzing, and I went on from there to find these groups that, and now when I wander around town, you know, I meet people and ask them would they like to present, and I've gathered a terrific group of young adults who all have really inspiring stories.
It's not often that people even think to include atheists or secular humanists.
This is happening more. I mean, the state government and the Multicultural Commission, I think state or federal, have both in the last few years moved to include the humanist voices, maybe rationalist, in discussions about government policy around religions, education and beliefs and ethics and so on. So we're moving into a new time.
And does this ever, obviously it came about in the first place because there were schools that asked for it, but are there ever times where people actively don't want those voices included in interfaith things?
Well, this is the thing for us to interpret our work, because the ordinary teacher in a state school is swamped not only by their own work but by many offers of wonderful programs. Unless you get their attention, you probably won't get past WPB.
And do you ever find it hard to find presenters for such a thing?
No, I've found young adults have got the mentality for this, because the younger generation aren't burdened by the old arguments, even the one about does God exist. They are oriented to do something practical. And whether or not we reach year 10 kids with our offering of a conversation, the fact that we get these young adults into a kind of a team and let them meet each other and have some kind of rapport is creating a resource that's going to be good for our state, you know, for 50 years. So that's a well worth investing in, not just the conversations in the schools, but the drawing together of young adults across the board.
What do you think are the most common questions that the presenters are asked about?
Well, look, this isn't just made up for tonight, but really one of the most common questions is about, you know, what do you think of homosexuality? If we have a Muslim in the group, it'll be very common to ask the question that everyone's asking, why are you wearing hijab, or about jihad and stuff like that. People don't ask the God questions. Don't ask that religious stuff. They don't have any, the young people don't have the background to ask these questions that relate to institutional religion. So they're focused on life today.
So interestingly, that actually even in high school, asking about the sexuality is common. Do you think is it in a friendly way, or is it in a way that's accepting, or is it a
well? It's in a friendly way,
or is it just because it's a hot button issue?
Look, I think schools vary a lot. The most progressive schools have got what you call gay-friendly groups, gay support groups, and those students can be out. We hope that when these questions come up, when we don't seed them, but if this question comes up and often does, one of the presenters, or if I'm there, I will deliberately make an affirmative statement in regard to GLBTQI, and I will help. We think we're helping to make that a more acknowledged aspect of our mixed groups that we're in, and give those students some kind of a little bit of an encouragement if they're going to be there in the room, although maybe nobody will know.
I think that's a great point to note, is that just the normalization of, yeah, you know, these sort of issues, especially since the reality is there are going to be members of people there who are going to be diverse in some,
that's right,
in whether or not it be gender related or sexual orientation, and we need to at least let them know that there are options other than the ultimate conservative version of, well, you're just a sinner.
Well, that's right. I was in a school last year. It was a Catholic school, and I wasn't sure of my ground, but a girl asked a question, and I got up and I said, my concern today is really for those in our audience today who are dealing with orientation issues. And then I kind of dumped the teacher. I said to the teacher, I wonder what this school's policy is. And this teacher was marvelous. He got up and I think I gave him a platform that he otherwise couldn't have, to say, we accept that these young people are here and we want to be positive. So we thought we'd opened a window there. It was really great.
You've been listening to The Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. And I have to say that we are coming to the end of another episode, another show, and I've been talking to Paul. Now, Paul, I really want to thank you so much for being on the show. It's been absolutely wonderful.
Fantastic.
I think it's been great, these sort of programs you have, in particular, of course, the program in which we're going to schools, having young people from different faith backgrounds or belief backgrounds talking about religion, all of sort of things. If people want to maybe get in touch with you about those, they should be emailing you on beliefpathways@gmail.com.
Beliefpathways, no dot, @gmail.com. The website's coming under the same name. Belief Pathways is our thing. Belief Pathways.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again so much, Paul. You've been listening to The Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.